you are a one-way parent, what do? You go back home.
That's
park
it.
Is closed.
We
There's
tried.
You can do. We tried. Inshallah, next time.
Right.
And you put a child in a depression state.
Right.
If you're flexible, you say, let's go somewhere else.
Right. And on that note, dear Sayyid, we will go on a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how important it is to be flexible with your children. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Okay, so we got the point where we said that a parent needs to be flexible. And in flexibility, through being flexible, a parent gets to learn his mistakes as well, right? So sometimes you might do something, but okay, then realize it was wrong, and then you change your method, you adopt a different method.
Right.
So the more flexible you are, the more perceptive you are to learning new things. So you open the door to yourself to be open. If you look at, for example, the older generations, most of the times they have adopted a one-way method, either my way or the highway.
Yes.
And usually that, it might work wonders for the grown-ups, back the older generation, because the kids used to be scared, not like today. Today they have the more audacity to fight and
right.
talk to their parents. But back in the day, kids used to be oppressed and they accept it and they move on. So for the elders back in the day, it worked wonders.
Right.
But for the kids, though, put them in traumas, put them in psychological problems.
I would
and
argue even the
and
kids
diseases.
Of
yeah,
the previous generations were traumatized
exactly.
as well.
So most of the problems that we have today that keeps accumulating generation after generation is because what's been done wrong in the previous era. So what we need to do is that being flexible yourself, not adopting that method, either my way or the highway, of being saying, you know what, let me try. If I make a mistake, let me learn from it. Let me change it, right?
Right.
They always, even psychologists, they give the example of a fly that wants to leave the room, and every time it tries to get out, it hits the window.
Yes.
And keeps hitting. Have you seen the fly? Just keeps hitting the window, the
right.
same window. Even
right.
though sometimes the door is open. And I've seen this
I've seen this
myself.
Many times.
And I use it sometimes. I have two birds, and I let them free sometimes. Sometimes I'll put them in the cage. One of the birds, it goes in the room. And she tries to go through the window, and it's closed, and she keeps, like, flies back and in. And the
right.
door is right next to it, and just never sees it. It tires itself out, because it's always adopting what? The same method. She's not being flexible. Now,
right.
they didn't. The psychologist or the whoever were in charge, they done the same study with a rat or a mouse, where they put a cheese at one corner, and they put a maze. And that rat or that mouse managed to find its way to the cheese. What they did next, they moved the cheese to a different location. The mouse came straight to the same location, did not
right.
find the cheese, and started looking for the cheese elsewhere, and then found
right.
it. So it automatically, you know, the brain of the mouse said, well, okay, it's not here, somewhere else. Let me try.
It's flexible, in short.
The flexibility
right.
makes a lot of difference. It makes you move from A to B. If you're constantly stuck, even the mind of your children, when they want to deal with you, they will deal with you based on the fact that, okay, my father is black and white.
Inflexible.
Either A or Z. He has no other.
He's not reasonable.
He's not reasonable.
Right.
So even the way they act, even the way they will deal with the parents, in that manner as well. So you kind of, in a way or another, turn them into robots.
Right.
They're not flexible themselves.
Right.
They're not creative themselves. You deprive them of a lot of things. Just for the fact that you're not being flexible. So being flexible, thinking outside the box, and giving it more options, more chances, is actually more beneficial to you and to your kids.
And with that, dear listeners, we will be going on a quick break.
Ya Muqdiya al-Khayrat, Ya Muqdiya al-Khayrat, Ya Muqdiya al-Khayrat.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, Excessive blame causes the fire of obstinacy to flame.
Welcome back to your listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how important it is to be flexible. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
When we talk about flexibility, that some parents, they have set rules and regulations when it comes to dealing with their kids that they themselves, they never cross. Okay, and that itself could be problematic for the kids themselves or for the parents themselves. Because, for example, sometimes as a parent, you might have a set time for your kids that every day they sleep at 8.
Right.
But on the weekends, you break that. You say, yeah, it's okay. You can stay up late. There's no school tomorrow. Then,
right.
you've messed up the whole plan. So what happened is then the kids, they start to say, okay, if I can do it today, I can do it tomorrow. I can do it any other day. And then you see this argument happening. But as if you are flexible with your kids, for example, throughout the week, you can,
you give and take.
Give and take. Okay, you can, the child, maybe he's not ready to sleep. Maybe he has too much energy, this and that.
His
okay,
favorite
I'll
show
give you,
is
I'll
on.
I'll give you extra hour.
Right.
You can sleep. So the child feels that flexibility, and he moves with his parents based on this flexibility. Otherwise, if you give him like a day where he's free to do, like he can stay up all night, and then the second day later, he doesn't feel like sleeping. So now you have to sleep. Then you see the child being, arrogant
right.
and fighting and, being rebellious. Well, obviously, that's a problem.
Right.
So having always a set method doesn't constantly work. In some cases, there are things you can be set with, but a lot of things you have to be flexible with, right? So there
right.
are a lot of things, sometimes there are things you need to take seriously, and you need to keep them as they are, and there are times you are required to have this flexibility with your kids. For example, even when it comes to matter of giving them gifts, right?
Right.
Be more flexible in giving gifts. Don't always give one gift, or don't give the same gift all the time, or the gift of the same kind.
You mean do
like
not always give them toys?
Even with toys itself. Sometimes they might like a particular toy. They like Legos, for example.
Right. Yeah.
If you keep constantly giving them Legos, you're not being creative yourself.
Right.
Give them different toy, for example. Bring them something else completely different from outside the circle. So the kid can have a chance himself to be more creative with that toy itself, not
right.
constantly his mindset. So when it comes to, for example, to punishment and him making a mistake, every time he makes a mistake, deal with it on a different manner, where the child himself feels that, you know what, my father is not constantly set on a particular method.
Yeah.
So being a successful parent, being a successful educator, you need to have that flexibility in dealing with your kids. And like I said, not only with your kids, but dealing with everyone around you.
With everything.
With everything. So even with people, you need to be
especially with people.
Flexible.
People are not robots. They
yeah.
all act and behave differently.
And we have a hadith from Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi. He says, don't be too harsh, too hard that you can be broken, and don't be too lean that you can get squeezed. Right?
Right. That's a very beautiful narration.
Yes. He said, لا تكن صلبا فتكسر ولا لينا فتأسر.
Because you're too inflexible, you will
exactly.
break as soon as you fall.
Yeah, exactly. If you're too harsh, you can break it very easy. If
right.
it's too soft, you can squeeze it. Be in between. Meaning
right.
have that flexibility. You know, like when you have mud, which is in between,
yeah.
this is what you need to have.
Right.
Have the flexibility to mold yourself in whatever situation that you're in.
And on that note, dear Sayyid, we will end today's program. Dear Sayyid, I thank you for your time and for your insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If the dear listeners have any questions or other relevant comments and feedback, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. You can also visit our website, parstoday.com. Alternatively, you can also find us on the various social media accounts we have on YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanu al-la'in ar-rajim. Bismillahi ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Previously, we were looking at human rights from the eyes and perspective of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salamullah. And we shall continue looking at this topic through his perspective. Among the things that Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, he gave high priority to is the right of family and the right of marriage and the right of childhood. Now, we do understand that among the most simple, basic fundamentals of rights is on the person is the right to create a family. For Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, he considers it to be the basic, the foundation of any society, of any civilization. So Islam came and he put the foundation and laid the rules to creating a strong family and gave it its rights and gave it protection, because through the successful family we have a successful society, and through a successful society we have a successful country, and we have a successful world. So the entire universe, or at least let's say the entire earth itself, consists of people who live amongst each other, be it in nations, be it in tribes, be it in small communities. And the basic and the first brick that we have to lay is the family itself. So it consists of that family. So the Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam and Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, first and foremost, they put a great emphasis on the relationship between two partners, and they consider this you know, the link between the strength of the community, the strength of the society, the strength of the ummah, and the relationship itself. So if this relationship continues, then so would society. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he considers getting married, creating a family, having children is a natural right of every human being. And he was dealing with this issue from a realistic perspective. by identifying the problems and by identifying where things could go wrong and what is necessary for the continuation of humanity itself, beginning with trying to touch on the human sexual desire itself, because sometimes it is the cause of corruption and sometimes it is a distraction of society, distraction of families, destruction of relationship itself between two partners. If this not being dealt with in a proper manner, this sexual relationship of a person or his desire to have his sexual needs met, if they are not dealt with in a correct manner, it would turn the human being into an animalistic person, or at least he will be an animal in the real sense of the word, that will create and cause corruption on earth. Unless that is met and that is being dealt with, things will go wrong. So we can see even through the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, when he talks to people when it comes to the matter of their sexual desire, he says it needs to be controlled, it needs to be maintained, it needs to be at least put in a way where it's only used in the correct manner. Now, there's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi where he talks to specifically men in this regard, because sometimes we are blaming women for everything, but Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi says it's an equal responsibility when it comes to men and women, when it comes to controlling their desires and not letting it run wild that causes corruption and problems in community, or at least in the family to begin with. Let us take a short break and then inshallah we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Just before the break, we were saying Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam was talking to men about controlling their sexual desires in order to have a safer family, safer relationship, and a safer community in return. So he says, إِيَّاكَ وَكَثْرَةِ الْوَلَهِ بِالنِّسَاءِ, I warn you and not to dive too deep in your desires in women. وَالْإِغْرَاءَ بِاللَّذَّاتِ, and do not indulge yourself too much in desires. فَإِنَّ الْوَلَهَ بِالنِّسَاءِ وَالْمُغْرَى بِاللَّذَّاتِ مُمْتَهَنِ, for he who indulges too much in women and too much in desires, he will be humiliated. So such a person who lives on this line where he only wants to meet his desires, he is not a valued member of society. He's not going to contribute to society, because all that he cares about is himself. If he's satisfied, if he has what he needs, then he's okay. If he's not, then he will go around creating problems for the community and for the society and for the entire nation together. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, when he comes and looks at marriage as a constitution, he looks at it as a holy constitution that needs to be respected, and he lays the foundation to this constitution itself. Now, what we need to understand is that the societies that we live in and the oppressors and the tyrants of each society, the causes of their tyranny, the causes of their oppression usually stems from personal moral, corrupted moral vices. When these people themselves are corrupted when it comes to their desires and their vices, or obviously they will take that onto people. Even Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, when he looks at, for example, the social level or political level, he says it gets destroyed because people become, as he uses the word, the urban wasalatina. They become nothing but wolves and tyrants. And then he talks about how they eat the wealth and the money of those who are poor, and they take it by power. And they use, whether it is lying, whether it is, you know, fighting with people, and they just use all these kind of methods to take the rights of other people. So he says from here, unless a person, first and foremost, gets to control himself and maintains his morals and values, then he is a threat to society itself. From here, he comes and lays the foundation that these people, because they have that desire, because they're human beings, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has embedded such a thing into them, it's a thing that they cannot deny, a thing they cannot get rid of. Rather, they have to deal with it in the correct manner. From here, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa and Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam and all other Imams and even the Quran, they laid the foundation to starting a prosperous, happy relationship and a happy family. And that is the right of every human being. This is not limited to the elite. This is not limited to a specific level of community or a level of the society. This should be the right of everybody. If that's maintained, if that's covered, then we should have a prosperous, happier society. Inshallah, we'll continue this topic in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Salli ya Rabbi ala Taha al-Amin, rahmatin arsaltahu lil'alamin, wa ala alin nabiyyi ajma'in, fa bihim narjuka ahsin khatmina.
In the limelight.
Iran's President Sayyid Ebrahim Raisi says the Islamic Republic is absolutely serious in its pursuit of the removal of all U.S. illegal and cruel sanctions in the talks slated to be held later this month in Austria's capital, Vienna, on the fate of the troubled 2015 multilateral nuclear deal. We now present you an article written by Ali Reza Karimi under the heading, Why Iran Has the Right to be Strict in Vienna Talks. On 8th of May 2018, the world media broadcast a picture of then-US President Donald Trump signing an executive order, a decree that ended US's partnership in the nuclear deal between Iran and the 5+1 group of countries, the United Nations Security Council's five permanent members plus Germany. The agreement, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, had previously been considered by many countries and even by the Americans themselves the outcome of success of multilateralism in international relations. But U.S. President at the time Donald Trump annulled it with the stroke of a pen. Much of Iran's benefits in the accord were enshrined under U.S. commitments, but Iranians have always stressed that they were not properly implemented, even when the United States was a party to the JCPOA. However, the story of U.S. withdrawal from JCPOA did not end there. In addition to the restoration of previous sanctions and all-out expansion of restrictive measures under various labels, Washington blocked all parties that were seeking to implement UN Security Council Resolution 2231 by adhering to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Therefore, the United States demonstrated that it does not honor even a UN Security Council resolution which it had once voted for. On the other hand, the three European signatories to the JCPOA, France, Germany, and Britain, were unable or unwilling to take an effective action to fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA following the US pullout. Thus, their financial mechanism to engage with Iran, called INSTEX, did not work in practice. Nevertheless, Iran fully fulfilled its commitments under the JCPOA for a year after the US withdrawal from the agreement. Former U.S. President Donald Trump signed the executive order to withdraw from the JCPOA while, according to all International Atomic Energy Agency reports, Iran had fulfilled its obligations to the full and was under the strictest nuclear inspection and transparency regime. Tehran pursued the same path for a year after the U.S. pullout from the JCPOA, and again the IAEA reports confirmed again and again Iran's adherence to the agreement. During his election campaign, Donald Trump had called the JCPOA the worst deal in American history. Meanwhile, his friends in West Asia encouraged him to scrap the nuclear agreement with Iran, including Benjamin Netanyahu in the occupied Palestinian territories, and Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. They, along with hardline U.S. senators such as Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton, who had undeniable anti-Iranian views, and John Bolton, a former U.S. National Security Advisor who later turned into Donald Trump's serious critic, paved the way for the United States to turn its back on its international commitments. Although the JCPOA was criticized by some politicians in Iran from the beginning for its imbalance of input and output, as well as its approach with regards to trusting the United States as a long-time enemy of the Islamic Revolution, the deal was respected and implemented as a decision of the then administration, and Tehran did not renounce it. Finally, 1 year after America's withdrawal, Iran began to reduce its nuclear commitments under the JCPOA. In Iran, a serious question on the minds of many people is, why is the country still honoring the deal, despite the U.S. pullout and the strict reimposition of sanctions, which have led to economic problems and the suffering of the nation? However, the Americans may not be aware that this reduction of commitments was precisely based on an article of the same agreement, i.e. Article 37. The article, approved by the UN Security Council as part of an annex to Resolution 2231, states, should sanctions be reimposed fully or partially, Iran will regard this as a ground for suspending all or part of its obligations under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Accordingly, Iran's right to reduce its commitments under the agreement has been recognized and approved by the UN Security Council in the event that sanctions are reimposed. The same declaration is also mentioned in Article 26 of the JCPOA itself. Thus, the picture projected by US officials concerning the violation of the JCPOA is unrealistic. With the suspension of Iran's nuclear commitments, which took place gradually and in several steps, a series of developments in the United States eventually put a controversial end to Donald Trump's administration and brought Joe Biden to power. Joe Biden, who was himself the vice president under the government that had signed the JCPOA with Iran, called for a return to the accord. However, soon the Biden administration showed that it was in no hurry to do so, and that a return to its commitments under the UN Security Council Resolution 2231 was essentially not a priority. As a result, Donald Trump's illegal and cruel sanctions against Iran have continued to this day. Negotiations were held between Iran and the 4+1 group, the remaining parties to the JCPOA, as the US presence to review the resumption of the US membership in the agreement. The talks continued for six rounds, but in practice they did not result in a U.S. return to the nuclear deal, as Washington refused to remove all sanctions imposed on Iran or to give the country a chance to verify the sanctions' removal. With the elections in Iran and the government of President Said Ebrahim Raisi taking office, the Vienna talks were suspended for a short time and are scheduled to resume on 29th of November 2021. But what approach would Iran enter these negotiations with? Recently, the Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said the main goal pursued by Iran during the forthcoming talks with the remaining parties to the JCPOA is that Iran wants to secure removal of all illegal sanctions imposed on the country. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark in a recent phone call with his Polish counterpart Zbigniew Rau, during which the two sides discussed bilateral relations as well as regional and international developments. During the phone call, Iran's top diplomat stressed the main goal pursued by Tehran through participation in the forthcoming talks in Vienna, Austria, is removal of all illegal sanctions imposed on Iran by the United States after the latter withdrew from the agreement in 2018. Hossein Amir Abdollahian added, "All participants in Vienna talks have reached a common understanding that the United States is the main party to blame and is responsible for the current state of negotiations." After withdrawal from JCPOA, former U.S. President Donald Trump launched a maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic, which he claimed was aimed at compelling Iran into negotiating a new deal. In the latest development surrounding this issue, Washington's Persian Gulf allies, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates, welcomed the upcoming seventh round of Vienna talks and even called for an urgent mutual return to full compliance with the JCPOA, despite the fact that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, in addition to the Israeli regime, had cheered Donald Trump's withdrawal from the nuclear deal and his maximum pressure policy against Iran. Furthermore, Iran's president, Said Ebrahim Raisi, says the Islamic Republic is absolutely serious in its pursuit of the removal of all U.S. sanctions in the talks slated to be held later this month in Vienna, Austria. In a phone call on Tuesday, 16th of November, with Russian President Vladimir Putin, whose country is also a party to the agreement, the Iranian president, Said Ebrahim Raisi, praised Moscow's position in defense of Iran's nuclear rights and the necessity of the removal of all sanctions imposed on the Islamic Republic by the United States. Said Ebrahim Raisi said, "The Islamic Republic of Iran is absolutely serious in the negotiations, and we are equally serious in ensuring the right of our nation to have the sanctions removed." It is almost clear that Iran's main purpose in participating in the talks is to remove all illegal U.S. sanctions, which have caused the suffering of the Iranian people. The Iranian government feels responsible to act if there is a possibility to remove the sanctions under fair conditions. On the other hand, Iran has repeatedly stressed that it is ready to return to its full obligations under the JCPOA whenever other parties meet their commitments and the sanctions removal is verified. However, Iran's experience shows that it cannot negotiate with a lenient approach towards the Americans. Washington easily violated UN Security Council Resolution 2231, reinstated and expanded sanctions against Iran, and even blocked Iran's access to medicine and food. Additionally, it carried out terrorist acts against Iran and martyred a senior Iranian military commander on the soil of a third country. Naturally, without verification and receiving necessary guarantees, no agreement can be reached with a country that has such a history. This is while the U.S. Republicans are vowing that they will once again violate the deal if they take helm of the U.S. executive branch of government. Moreover, the possibility of Donald Trump's return to power has become serious, given Joe Biden's poor performance, and especially the debacle of U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. The question is, if Western politicians wanted to decide in a similar situation, would they be open to a new agreement and scaling back their nuclear programs without a guarantee? The answer to this question seems evident.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The competition between the U.S. and its eastern rivals, namely Russia and China, is entering new domains. Washington is set to strengthen its military grip in Africa, a move that's meant to counter Moscow and Beijing's growing influence on the continent. The issue is proposed in a sweeping defense bill that will be debated in Congress as soon as Thursday. If passed, the National Defense Authorization Act will be the first security initiative openly authorized by Congress since the Cold War to funnel military aid to African forces to counter Beijing and Moscow. The proposal lays the new groundwork for a long-term bid to expand U.S. military influence in Africa.
They don't care about development. They may say they want to see this and that, but all their work is on implementing their democracy and their conception of human rights on African nations, and some military support. And rather than seeing the enemy as poverty in Africa, they see the enemy as Russia and China. Very stupid, very foolish, but unfortunately, that's the way United States leaders are thinking right now.
Back in 2013, when AFRICOM was first established, only two African countries showed a willingness to host American bases. But now, even South Africa, which once led a campaign against American intervention on the continent, has hosted drills with the U.S. But that's a cause for concern, particularly considering the spike in coup attempts in East and West Africa, areas that host the largest concentration of U.S. bases. At least seven coups over the past 13 years have reportedly involved troops trained under AFRICOM. The U.S. maintains its military presence in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but human rights groups say civilians have been caught in the crossfire and casualties from U.S. airstrikes are higher than have been reported. The United States' increased foothold in Africa has raised concerns, as the country hasn't had a good track record even when it comes to delivering on its stated claims of fighting terrorism. Take Somalia, for example, where the U.S. has been conducting airstrikes against al-Shabaab terrorists for a decade. Despite the U.S. attacks, al-Shabaab has proven resilient and is still able to carry out high-profile attacks in the country and neighboring states such as Kenya. In addition, rights groups have long accused AFRICOM of shrouding its operations in secrecy and denying accountability for civilians killed in its airstrikes. The U.S. has failed to provide an accurate tally of the equipment and resources it has sent to U.S. Africa Command partner nations in its most recent audit. That has raised concerns that the equipment might have fallen into the wrong hands. The U.S. military clearly has accountability issues in Africa. The question is, why isn't Washington taking any initiative to improve the economies on the African continent to compete with China and Russia that are already working on several projects there?
In crude terms, either you have your foot on the other guy's throat or he has it on yours. And therefore, rather than seeing the world as the potential for expanding and developing the nations of the world, this Western geopolitical oligarchy says, no, we have to always remain on top, and everything they look at in the world is judged from this diseased geopolitical doctrine, which the British developed several hundred years ago.
What the U.S. needs to keep in mind when making decisions about investing militarily in Africa are the lessons from the outcome of its 20-year-long war in Afghanistan, as all the American lives lost and all the funds spent there turn out to be for nothing.
The cost of living in the UK surged in October to a 10-year high, with the figure now more than double the target set by the Bank of England. The UK's Consumer Prices Index rose by 4.2% in the 12 months to October, up from 3.1% in September. Driven by a dramatic jump in household gas and electricity prices, the figure was higher than forecast by economists.
Now, there's a lot of different factors. The big one, of course, is the incompetence of Boris Johnson's government, which cut Britain off from its major sources of trade and raw materials, has made everything much more expensive. He's managed to introduce, you know, they've reintroduced customs charges, they've reintroduced processing charges that didn't exist in a free market. So, of course, prices go up.
With the annual inflation rate more than double the 2% target set by the government for the Bank of England, the increase will put pressure on the bank to raise interest rates from as early as next month amid growing concern over the cost of living. Rising consumer prices have ramped up the cost of living, especially when wages have failed to keep pace. The Bank of England expects inflation to rise further to around 5% in the spring of 2022, before falling back towards its 2% target by late 2023.
Now, there are two aspects of all of this. The inflation is a question of the value of the currency. When the currency is devalued, you get inflation. But rising prices are a separate issue. Not all prices are rising. Not, you know, on the contrary, property and some things are going down.
As the impact of higher oil and gas prices fades and demand for goods moderates, household energy bills were the biggest driver of inflation after Ofgem, the energy regulator, lifted the price cap on domestic gas and electricity last month. It meant that gas bills rose by 28.1% in the year to October, while electricity climbed by 18.8%.
Most working people in the Western world have been on certainly in the Anglo-speaking world, have been on a petrol pay freeze since Ronald Reagan in 1975 in real terms. Their wages have been held down, while productivity and profits and the share that the bankers take has rocketed upwards.
Demand for oil and gas is pushing up energy prices worldwide. This means higher bills for householders and for businesses, many of whom will pass on some or all of the extra energy costs to their customers. UK authorities in October lifted the so-called energy price cap, which limits standard variable tariffs charged by domestic energy providers.
The effect is catastrophic. In Britain, the energy prices shot up, and the government's response was to cut back on the welfare spending, to cut back on the money that unemployed and ill people got. So they've deliberately targeted poorer people.
UK and European gas prices have hit one-month highs as concerns over winter energy supplies rise. Delays to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline from Russia have stoked fears of a winter natural gas shortage in Europe. Germany has suspended its approval process for the controversial Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, which would double its reliance on Russian gas following growing geopolitical pressure to scrap the project. The suspension of the Nord Stream certification is a setback to Gazprom's plans to extend Russian gas dominance via a new pipeline across the Baltic Sea. Europe faces a looming winter gas crisis, which has fueled fears of a widespread industrial slowdown due to factory shutdowns and potential power outages. It is also expected to drive a cost of living crisis for homes and small businesses. Gas prices have reached record highs in recent months, ignited by the global surge in demand after the COVID-19 economic slowdown last year, and fueled by Russia's reluctance to export extra supplies to Europe to help meet demand, despite rocketing market prices.
Thank you.
The Sudanese military forced Omar al-Bashir out of the presidential post in August 2019. After Bashir's ouster, the military came under mounting pressure by mass street demonstrations demanding civilian rule. The military finally agreed to share power with civilian leaders. The two sides agreed to negotiate a path towards a democratic government. After the agreement, civilians and military leaders formed a joint committee known as the Sovereign Council to run the country together in what appeared to be a transition period before a democratically elected government takes charge. But the two sides were publicly at odds from the very beginning. Military leaders of the Sovereign Council kept demanding their civilian counterparts to replace the cabinet and implement reforms. Civilian leaders dismissed this as an attempt to seize power. Sudan experienced several failed coups since 2019. The country is right now in political turmoil following the military's latest try. Back in October, the military arrested Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and his cabinet members and dissolved the government. Is the army trying to keep power, or is it genuinely committed to holding elections as it has promised? Army Chief General Abdel Fattah Abdelrahman Burhan says a vote will be held in July 2023. But Sudanese activists and demonstrators seem not to be buying that pledge. They have held several mass demonstrations calling on the general to cede power immediately. The army has clamped down on the protests in recent weeks, but the demonstrators seem to be undeterred by the bloody crackdown. The crackdown on anti-coup protesters has been getting bloodier. This means that pro-democracy camps and activists are facing an increasingly dangerous struggle. The violent crackdown has triggered international condemnation, with UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet describing it as utterly shameful to use live bullets against protesters. The current situation in Sudan is reminiscent of June 2019, before the democratic transition was agreed. That year, the army opened fire on protesters in the capital, Khartoum, killing scores of people. Undaunted by the latest violence, opponents of the coup have now pledged to intensify their protests against the military takeover. The Sudanese Professional Association, which led the popular uprising that toppled Omar al-Bashir, has been a major force against coup leaders. It has called for civil disobedience across Sudan. The African country is on the edge. Popular movements in Sudan have in the past been successful in forcing the generals to limit their involvement in politics. Is that the path the Sudanese people need to take again?
I do think that what we saw in 2019 with the protests were extremely positive in showing the rest of the world what the Sudanese people can do and what the Sudanese masses can do. However, even the Sudanese Communist Party had mentioned how important it was to recognize this material impact of the protests have not been recognized by the masses themselves. So the poor and working class Sudanese people have not yet seen any of their material needs resolved as a result of the protests. So that's probably the biggest push they're trying to see now, is ensuring that this next government actually does listen to their needs, material needs.
What's making the situation even worse this time is Sudan's economic crisis, with high inflation and nationwide shortages of food and fuel. The Sudanese army chief seems to have the final say, at least for now. But he is definitely in no easy position as tensions escalate and people lose their lives in violence. The international community has left little doubt that it disapproves of the developments in Sudan. All eyes are on the army now to see what direction it will choose.
There is no end in sight for the plight of the Rohingya Muslims. Already living in sprawling refugee camps that are said to be one of the most densely populated places on earth, the Muslims in the Bangladeshi city of Cox's Bazar say they are being hunted down by police and local criminal gangs alike. Following the assassination of prominent Rohingya activist Mohibullah in September, the Bangladeshi police have launched a heavy-handed crackdown on the camp residents. The refugees say the law enforcement is using the crackdown as an excuse to treat them aggressively. They allege that the police have blackmailed, extorted, and even sexually assaulted them.
There's no safety and security in the camp. And that is why anyone can come in and commit crimes, and not many people dare enough to make noise in order to talk about the gang activities or any criminal activities because they become the target.
According to a New York Times report, the refugees are being put on a hit list by violent gangs. In less than a month, at least 8 people have reportedly been assassinated by ARSA, a large militant group that is trying to impose its own rule over the displaced Rohingya.
ARSA, the Arkan Rohingya Salvation Army. They enter the camp for years, coming in to recruit their troops or coming in and doing other businesses. And also you have drug dealers, drug traffickers who come in and making profit out of the refugees. And you also have other perpetrators who come in, prey on women and children, and or to human traffickers to abduct people to just sell them to other countries.
The menaces the refugees are facing come on top of the poor living conditions in the overcrowded shelters and inclement weather that's threatening their lives and what's left of their belongings. The United Nations and Bangladesh's government signed a deal in mid-October to work together to aid and serve Rohingya refugees on Basan Char Island in the Bay of Bengal, where more than 19,000 people have been relocated from overcrowded camps near Myanmar's border. According to the UN, the agreement allows the refugees to move back and forth between the island and the main camp in Cox's Bazar. The UN has also noted that moving to the island would be voluntary. Authorities in Bangladesh have announced that another 81,000 refugees would be relocated to the island over the next 3 months. The development comes as most of the Rohingya refugees are not pleased with the relocation and say life on the island is hard for them. The agreement has also marked a shift, as the UN used to criticize the relocation, saying the island was regularly hit by cyclones, heavy monsoon rains, floods, landslides, and other natural hazards, and was not fit for habitation. However, the Bangladeshi government claims that it has spent tens of millions of dollars on the island's development, insisting that it's no longer a vulnerable area.
Those who are in the authority, they've been informed. But then the UNHCR will be saying, oh, that's the Bangladesh government authority and responsibility to take care of the refugee security. But at the same time, you also have the Bangladesh government who is worrying that the Rohingya will be living here forever if they feel safe. They wouldn't want to go anywhere or go back to Burma.
The standards of living haven't changed much for the refugees in the past few years. They were facing murder, rape, and torture at home. The same atrocities are haunting them kilometers away in Bangladesh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Emergency crews in Western Canada were still trying to reach some 18,000 people stranded by landslides and struggling to find food among bare grocery store shelves after devastating flooding. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Leyland Sesso, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Canada Floods, 18,000 people still stranded in terrible, terrible disaster. Stay tuned for more. Emergency crews in Western Canada were still trying to reach some 18,000 people stranded by landslides and struggling to find food among bare grocery store shelves after devastating flooding. John Horgan, the premier of British Columbia province, declared an emergency recently. In an emotional address, the province's public safety minister, Mike Franworth, said, "This has been a terrible, terrible disaster, but I know this. As British Columbians, as Canadians, we stick together. I want to come out of this. I'm going to build a stronger, better province and a stronger and better country," he said. Appearing to fight back tears, he said, "Canadians are supporting our province, that we are one big family, and absolutely that, to me, is something that we all instinctively know. It is absolutely just a remarkable feature and facet of our communities, our people, our province, and our country." One person is confirmed dead in a landslide that swept vehicles off a road near the village of Pemberton, but with many other missing and with searches still coming through the debris, that number is almost certain to rise. Meanwhile, communities in already inundated areas brace for more rain next week. Henry Broome, mayor of the city of Abbotsford, where officials kept close watch over a pumping station, said, "I'm not concerned about today's rain. What I'm concerned about is next week and what's coming. If the pumps failed," Broome warned, "the results would be catastrophic for a community already grappling with thousands of drowned farm animals and a bill that could reach $1 billion to rebuild the city." As the military joined the effort to rescue thousands left stranded by the floods, residents say the recent days have exposed the vulnerability of small communities to natural disasters worsened by the climate crisis. When Crystal Babak got word that a wildfire was approaching her community of Merritt earlier this summer, she and her family prepared to leave as dark clouds of smoke blacked out the sky. The town was spared, but when turbid flood waters rushed through it months later, Babak knew she couldn't leave. Her mother needed care and her father was without a vehicle. "I just sat there speechless. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to think. You're told to grab what you can and get out. Some people didn't even have time to grab anything," she said. As officials issued a mandatory evacuation order, she stayed behind. She and a handful of others are the few that remain in the mountain town submerged in muddy water earlier this week. The family has taken to using their motorhome as a restroom and are washing everything pioneer style in basins after the town's water treatment plant shut down. They have enough food and friends have passed them water and supplies at a police checkpoint near the town limits. With most roads closed, the majority of Merritt's 7,000 residents traveled to nearby Camp Luce, where they were told by emergency services that shelter and warm food was waiting. Soon, stories began trickling back of long lines to find shelter. Melanie Racher arrived in Camp Luce with her husband, family, diabetic mother, and elderly father to find hundreds of people waiting ahead of them to be temporarily housed. And quickly, hundreds lined up behind her. Despite promises from emergency services of the province,